You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are outside Vinoteca in London's King's Cross.
Boom, we are. Well done. I'm Richard Moore. That's Lionel Burney. And we're with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
Hello, Daniel.
How's it going?
How are you?
Not too bad. Why? Why do you look sceptical, dubious already? Even before I've said anything.
I don't know. Just natural state. Here we are in London then, gathered a few days before the Vuelta. When do you head off, Daniel?
Thursday.
Lionel?
Saturday morning. Flying in very late, Richard. Very relaxed for the holiday grand tour.
Got your bucket and spade packed?
I have, yeah. Wide-brimmed hat. Looking forward to...
Heading to which Costa, Lionel? I need to test on your Costas.
Well, it's the Benidorm...
Costa Coffee?
No. No, let's not mention that.
It's the Costa Blanca.
Correct.
Yes. I had to think about that. The Costa del Sol was last year. Costa Brava's a bit further up around the corner. What are the other Costas?
The Costa del Azahar. That's the one around Valencia. We're going there. Costa Dorada, which is a bit further up between Azahar and Brava.
3 or 4 days in the Benidorm region, Daniel, to kick off the Vuelta. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've tried to dodge that as much as possible by staying south of Alicante, which is the non-Benidorm side. But it's not the most pleasant part of Spain, is it?
No, I'm looking forward to the bingo on Sunday afternoon. That'll be good.
I always think south of Alicante is the sea, but actually, because I always think that the Costa Blanca is the very south of Spain, but it's not really. It's the east coast.
Yeah, it's on the side, isn't it? Calpe's nice, though. I've never been in the height of summer, though. It could be a very different place when it's full of tourists. I mean, you only have to look at the number of hotels there are on that coast to know what it's going to be like in summer. I've never been there in the summer. I'm being critical of somewhere I've not been
in the height of the
tourist season.
There a couple of years ago when the Vuelta went through Benidorm and finished just the other side of Calpe up that climb, which is called Daniel. I'll tell you who attacked on that climb. Richard Carapaz, and it was the first time I really sort of became aware of him a couple of years ago. But I remember the stage that day went through Benidorm, and the roads were lined with people in swimwear holding plastic glasses of beer. It was wonderful.
That will be me on Sunday morning when the stage starts there, I think, on Sunday morning. I mean, it zigzags around, doesn't it, on that coast. It kicks off, of course, with a team time trial on Saturday evening.
We should tell people what sort of coverage they'll be getting from the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta.
We're going to be doing some podcasts, Richard, but...
The usual Grand Tour coverage is the answer, because a few people have been asking. We'll be producing daily episodes, nightly episodes, and 9 episodes of Kilometre Zero, supported by Hans Grohe again. And so they'll come out Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and the nightly episodes will come out nightly.
Yeah, it could be slightly different to normal, though, couldn't it? I'm there for the first week. Richard, you're coming out on the, just in time for Andorra. I'll go home for the middle week, and then we'll both be in the final few days. I think the final 4 or 5 days. Daniel, you'll be there, of course, the whole race for ITV, but joining us on the podcast as well. And then, well, Orla Chenoui will be there as well, working for Eurosport. And, well, who else will we catch up with?
Well, Fran Race has been part of our coverage the last couple of years. Fran's now working for the organisation, but we will hopefully speak to Fran at various points, especially tap into his expertise.
We planted him in the organisation.
We haven't planted him, but we're going to obviously
a fox in the hen house.
Tap into his expertise on Spanish riders and teams. So lots to look forward to. Are you going to do outside the team buses, Lionel? That's the question everyone's lips.
I'm going to do an experimental silent segment of the podcast called Lionel's Siesta. That will come roughly 2/3 of the way through.
I think they call that slow radio, don't they?
And then
you do that during the Tour de France when Julian Pinot was supposed to. We were supposed to hear from Julian. Pinot.
No, we just left him out. There wasn't dead air in its place. Outside the team bus will return in some form or other, as will an exciting new segment of By the Pool.
Julian Pinot was accidentally left out of an episode, Daniel, as you correctly point out. He was then inserted back in. So I'm just like to for the record. Do you have a news roundup? We'll be looking ahead to the Vuelta, obviously, later on. But there's been some other news in the cycling world this week.
Yeah, starting off, Richard, with some sad news that Felice Gimondi, the Italian legend, really, has died age 76. It's fair to say he was one of the greatest riders of all time. Only the second man after Jacques Anquetil to win all three of the Grand Tours. He won the Tour de France not only at the first attempt, but during his first year as a professional rider. That was in 1965, and he was just 22 years of age. You could almost say, well, an achievement that sort of betters Egan Bernal's achievement in a way. He also won the Giro d'Italia three times in 1967, 69 and 76, and he won the Vuelta in 1968. He was world champion in 73. He also won Milan-San Remo, Paris-Roubaix and the Giro di Lombardia a couple of times. He was on holiday in Sicily last week and he suffered a heart attack while swimming, and Eddie Merckx has led the tributes from the cycling world, saying that with him goes a slice of my life. We'll talk about Gimondi and his career and his legacy in the second part of today's podcast. In the first part, we'll talk about the big transfer that we've been anticipating for a while now, but which has been confirmed this morning. First of all, Team Sunweb announced that Tom Dumoulin would be leaving the team at the end of the year, and then very soon after, also on social media, Jumbo Visma sort of obliquely announced his arrival in quite a slick video that just ended with a picture of a Jumbo Visma rider with Dumoulin. So they're welcoming him on board for next season. A couple of other high-profile transfers confirmed in the past week. Ireland's Dan Martin is joining the Israel Cycling Academy, and Lotto Soudal's Tish Benoot is swapping to Sunweb. A couple of interesting ones there. Lots of racing going on, as we talked about last week. The Bink Bank Tour was dominated for the first 3 days by Sam Bennett of Bora Hansgrohe. He won the first three stages. Tim Wellens of Lotto Soudal then won in Hoefelies to take the leader's jersey. Alvaro Hodge was the only man to beat Bennett in a sprint. He won stage 5, I think it was. Filippo Ganna.
A great race for the Celtic countries there, eh? With Ireland and Scotland.
Of course.
To the
Alvaro
fore.
Alvaro Hodge, the Scottish Argentinian. Yes. How could I forget? Filippo Ganna of Team Ineos, the Italian time trial champion, won the short time trial stage, and then the race came down to its now traditional finish on the Mur in Herrasberg, and Oliver Naassen, Greg Van Avermaet and Laurens De Ploes fought it out. Naassen of AG2R won the stage, and De Ploes of Jumbo Visma fully recovered from his illness at the Giro now, Richard, before you mention anything.
Well, he rode a very good Tour de France in the meantime.
True enough. He took the overall victories to bump Wellens down to third place. Now, the CPA, the Riders Union, has criticised the organisers of the Bink Bank Tour for, among other things, the narrow roads, unmarked obstacles, sudden bends in the road and holes in the road, especially near the finishes. They put out a press release saying that the safety of the race was suboptimal. There was also that extraordinary video, I don't know whether you saw it, of a member of the public pushing his own bike across a pedestrian crossing right in front of the bunch as they were coming. Quite miraculous that no one came down there. The CPA statement signs off by saying that it's become tired of being thanked for its report by the UCI, while, as they see it, nothing is done to improve rider safety. So that's something that's rumbling on. The Arctic Tour of Norway, well, it ended with a bit of beef between Warren Barguil and Enrico Gasparotto. They were in a group behind two Norwegians who were up the road. Alexei Lutsenko then got away and held a little gap to pinch the final time bonus and win the overall by a single second from Barguil, who then blamed Gasparotto for letting Lutsenko's wheel go. I mean, well, that's bike racing, no?
But then apologised to Gasparotto. Unless it's taken another twist today.
You say it's bike racing, but in that situation, should he not have given some sort of warning that he was? I don't know. He sort of duped Barguil into thinking that he was going to follow Lutsenko. Of course, there was some. I've seen some speculation, perhaps valid, that there was possibly some kind of deal between Gasparotto or Lutsenko, or at least their friendship, the fact they were former teammates at Astana, may have played some kind of role. I also thought Gasparotto, I don't know if you watched the first stage when Steve Cummings would tried to get away two or three times in the finale and very nearly won the stage. I also thought Gasparotto didn't do a great job as a teammate there. I'd be keen to get your thoughts on this. The whole issue of sort of interfering with meddling with a chase when you're effectively protecting a teammate who's down the road. We've seen it. We saw it a couple of times in the classics when De Koenig at Quickstep did it very well. How much is that frowned upon? Should you systematically do that as a team, as a teammate? Should you position yourself at the front of the bunch to sort of to kind of infiltrate the line of chasers?
Well, it does happen, doesn't it? I thought that was possibly
the difference between Cummings winning that stage and not winning it. Van der Poel did eventually catch him and won the sprint. But I don't know. I thought Gasparotto was... that maybe told us something about why Dimension Data have not been more successful this year. That they weren't really working as a team there anyway.
Well, as you say, Daniel, Mathieu van der Poel did win the opening stage. That was on his return to road racing after a couple of wins in the Mountain Bike World Cup. Meanwhile, at the Vuelta a Burgos, Team Ineos' young Colombian Ivan Sosa won a couple of stages in the overall. Ben Hermans of Israel Cycling Academy won the Tour of Utah. The Women's World Tour had a couple of events at the weekend. The Post-Nord Vorgorda team time trial was won by Trek Segafredo, who had Ruth Winder, Elisa Longo-Borghini, Ellen Van Dijk and Trixie Wardak in their team. They beat Canyon SRAM by 25 seconds. The WNT Rota team, including the former world champion Lisa Brennauer, were unable to take the start because they had a crash in the recon when a public car, pulled out in front of them, and according to them, it was the riders' right of way on the road. The riders were not injured, but their bikes were damaged, so they were unable to take part. The one-day race the following day was won by Italy's Mattia Bastianelli ahead of Mariana Voss and Lorena Wiebes. A couple of items from the World Junior Track Championships. India won their first medal at world level, taking the team sprint on the track in Frankfurt, and Eleanor Baxted won three medals for Great Britain. Eleanor Baxted, of course, is the daughter of former Paris-Roubaix winner Magnus Baxted and former British rider Megan Hughes. More British success at the Tour de l'Avenir, where Ethan Hayter and Tom Pidcock did a 1-2 on one of the stages, and Brad Wright won the following day. That race concludes at the weekend. Finally, Romain Bardet has ended his season. He's not racing again this year, but will continue to train as normal until the end of the season, according to a release from his team AG2R. And the Cycling Podcast was named in the Daily Mail's 100 Best Podcasts.
Thanks, Daily Mail.
Amongst some really stellar other podcasts from all...
As you expect, Lionel, top 100. I mean,
yeah,
you expect that. One other transfer, quickly, Victor Campenaerts. An email's just confirmed his move to Dimension Data. Just before we end the news roundup, Lionel, important news. It's not really news, but we'll flag it as news. Our Grand Tour, well, our events that we've got coming up, starting at the World Championships.
Yeah, well, it is news because our Grand Tour lineup is confirmed at long last. But before that, we'll be at the World Championships at the Royal Hall in Harrogate on Friday, September the 27th. Lots going on in Harrogate that week. I think Ned Bolting and David Miller are doing an event as well. Shouldn't plug that, should we, really? We hope people will come along to both events. No, won't.
Or just ours.
Or just ours, if it comes down to a choice, of course.
Yeah.
All tickets, by the way, as the thunder rumbles above us, are available from links from thecyclingpodcast.com and go to live events, which is in the menu tab. Now, the Grand Tour, we have two venues to announce, one in Dublin and one in Cambridge.
A homecoming gig for you, Lionel.
Well, absolutely. And absolutely. My first engagement in Dublin as an Irish citizen, indeed. But we will be in November darting around from Bristol to Cardiff to Worcester, Dublin, as I say, Belfast, two dates at the London Art Theatre in Leicester Square. We sold out there a couple of years ago. We're there on consecutive Mondays. We'll be in Cambridge at the West Road Concert Hall, then up in Edinburgh at Churchill Theatre, then Leicester and then Manchester. The dates are between November the 11th and November the 30th. The full list of dates is on our website, as I say. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events. And please do come along and see us.
Quick update on tickets. Harrogate is selling extremely well. We're going to have a big crowd in Harrogate, so thanks very much to everyone who's bought tickets for that. Still more available because it's a big venue. Belfast and Bristol are racing ahead, so thanks very much to people who bought tickets there. Worcester, though, come on, Worcester.
If you're in Worcester, or you can get
well,
to Worcester.
Probably not. I mean, we don't seem to have any listeners to the podcast. I mean, we've sold some tickets, but not many. So,
wow,
come on, Worcester.
We want to see a big crowd in Worcester as well. Very much looking forward to our tour around
the
country.
Worcester sauce.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa. You mentioned in the news roundup, Lionel, briefly, the Tour of Utah. Couple of successes there for EF Education First. Joe Dombrowski won the final stage, and Lachlan Morton. I was at the Tour of Utah last time he won there, and he won the overall. And it was, well, been a while since we've seen him win on the road, but of course he's been doing lots of other things. And a reminder that if you want to see a truly remarkable exploit, it's his ride from Land's End to John O'Groats as part of the GB Juro. And that was a 30-minute film made by Rafa. A really great watch, a really great insight into Lachlan Morton and his personality. And, you know, fascinating to see him go from that to carrying his bike across bogs to winning a stage at the Tour of Utah. And good to see him win again, actually. You'll find all the EF Gone Racing films at rafa.cc or on the Rafa channel on YouTube. Now, the big news today is Tom Dumoulin's confirmed move to Jumbo-Visma. As you said, we've seen it coming. It's been rumoured over the summer. Sunweb were playing a pretty straight bat at the Tour de France, saying that, you know, as far as they were concerned, he was under contract for another few years. He signed a long-term contract with them, but that's been broken. A move that I suspect is very, very important for Jumbo-Visma, a Dutch team which had a great year, but really needed that Dutch figurehead, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, Rich. Although Steven Kruiswijk obviously finished on the podium in the Tour de France, and I think it's about this dream of having a Dutch Tour de France winner. Also, you know, having a team which can compete on every front, really, particularly as far as the Grand Tours are concerned. And they've obviously got the money to be able to afford Tom Dumoulin. They've heavily invested Jumbo Supermarkets in speed skating, haven't they? I think they've heavily invested in Formula One with Max Verstappen. They've got some kind of sponsorship on some level with him. I'm not particularly au fait with Formula One, but I'm told that's the case. And it's not that surprising in this respect, but on the other hand, it's a team, well, which has had wild success really this year, particularly in the Tour de France with how many stage wins did they get in the end? Was it five or six? Four or five?
Mike Tönnesen on day one, of course, team time trial. Dylan Groenewegen,
Wout van Aert, and then they finished on the podium as well. So one of the most intriguing aspects of this move is the question of how they're going to fit, how they're going to sort of circle the square with Roglic, who finished on the podium in the Giro, and Kruiswijk, and now Dumoulin as well. They've all got designs, you would think, on the Tour de France. They've all sort of served their apprenticeship in the minor Grand Tours, and they will all want to, well, they all feel that they can compete for victory in the Tour de France. That's my reading of it. On the other hand, Kruiswijk, I mean, I spoke to some Dutch colleagues this year. They felt that his podium finish at the Tour was the result of a lifetime, and he might be, well, happy with that. Everything that comes now is a bonus. Maybe he will turn his attention to winning one of the major tours, the other major tours. Obviously, he came very close a couple of years ago at the Giro. So, you know, I mean, my reading of it is that they will have a sole leader at the Giro, and they will certainly have two leaders at the Tour de France, Dumoulin and one other maybe. But We also know that Dumoulin loves the Giro. Will he go back there? I think a lot will depend on the courses that are unveiled in the autumn.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that Jumbo-Visma's kind of attempts to go toe-to-toe with Team Ineos in the Grand Tours is taken another step forward in a big way, hasn't it? I mean, we've seen, well, we've talked about Team Ineos having so many different riders who are capable of winning a Grand Tour, and obviously we can't take for granted the level that Chris Froome comes back at next year, but it could well be that they would have Froome, Thomas, Bernal, the three most recent winners of the Tour de France, plus the defending Giro champion Richard Carapaz, all available for selection for the Tour de France next year, or have all of those cards to play. Jumbo-Visma are trying to kind of match that, and I think maybe that's a realisation on their part. And going back to your special at the start of the year, Richard, where, you know, the takeaway from that was that they weren't going to mess about in terms of trying to win the Tour de France. And signing Tom Dumoulin, a rider who has won the Giro and finished on the podium at the Tour, second place at the Tour, is a serious, serious move.
And I think the point you make about Steven Kruijswijk is a good one. Marin Zeiman, the coach at Jumbo-Visma, spoke to him on the Champs-Élysées about Kruijswijk, and he is the sort of the heart and soul of that team in a lot of ways. You know, he's been their project for a number of years, as is Roglic, actually. And Zeiman was quite honest, saying that he wasn't sure whether Kruijswijk could move up a level from this year, from finishing on the podium at the Tour. I think that is the realization of a dream with him, and his role might subtly alter now. He might be realistic in, you know, he's going to the Vuelta in what looks like a support role for Roglic, and that might be his role. I think also the result, Laurens De Ploes, is very significant at the Binkbank Tour. 23 years old, moved from De Koning Quickstep, and I think had some reservations himself about whether that was a wise move, and it has been, apart from the Giro, which was a disappointment for him. He was man of the match for Jumbo-Visma at the Tour de France. He was exceptional there, and to go from performing as he did there in the high mountains to winning a race like the Binkbank Tour, it was a real all-rounder sort of race. I think at 23 he's also potentially a future Grand Tour contender.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot in the last couple of years about eight-man teams in Grand Tours and the different problems that poses to team managers. And you think about Jumbo-Visma and you think about the amount of quality they managed to pack into their Tour de France roster this year. And also, Rich, Lionel mentioned your special earlier in the year, but this vision that their manager Richard Plugger had of being competitive on every single day of the Tour de France, of he almost had an epiphany 2 or 3 years ago that he no longer wanted to go to the Tour de France not being competitive every single day, not having a chance to win the stage. And you would think that in order to fulfill that equation, you have to have a sprinter, a frontline sprinter, which they've had with Groenewegen, but you throw a second bona fide leader into the mix, GC leader, and you also say that our objective is going to be to win the Tour de France. Is the space for Groenewegen? I mean, you can almost pick the team now, with George Bennett, Wout van Aert, Mike Tuynesen maybe, Laurens De Ploes, Groenewegen, Martin Kruijswijk and Dumoulin. But then already, if we're talking about the Tour de France, Groenewegen will lose a man, and that would be Janssen, the Norwegian lead out man that he had this year. Is that a sacrifice that he's willing to make? Is that a sacrifice that will still allow him to compete for the sprint stages? Not sure. And you also have to look just practically at the riders' contracts. Groenewegen is under contract for another year at least. Roglic has got another year, and it's been reported today that he's got a verbal agreement going beyond that, maybe until 2023, I think. So, I think that they'll all still be there next year, and there probably will be someone who will be slightly aggrieved when the selections are made for the Tour de France and the Giro. But I don't think it's an impossible circle to square. Square to circle? Circle to square?
Good question. Circle to square.
Well, they've got a kind of triangle of genuine podium contenders there now, haven't they? I think the way they rode the last few days of the Tour de France was quite instructive in a way. They really laid it on to bump Kruijswijk up to third place, and his delight at being third, and perhaps you're right, knowing that might be the limit of where he could get to overall, and perhaps never get a better chance to finish on the podium. But it does strike me that Kraalsvyk is exactly he has the attributes of the perfect, you know, super mountain domestique. You know, he can ride a very steady, hard, fast pace. We don't tend to see him on the front too much because he's a protected man, but you know, he has that energy, that engine to you could see him if he's kind of, you know, the ego side of his personality could dedicate himself to somebody else, he could be extremely valuable.
Well, I think that's why maybe the podium place was very important, and we'll see over the next few weeks at the Vuelta maybe how prepared he is, because at the Tour last year and at the Vuelta last year he was riding very much for his own GC ambitions. He may feel he's got another GC ride in him at the Vuelta, but Roglic is there as the obvious leader. And they might ride in a similar way where they're both kind of up there, or it might be that Kraalsvyk is required to actually sacrifice himself to help Roglic. There could be an interesting clue there. But I mean, the other aspect of this move is Demula. And I think, you know, with his talent and ability, this is an obvious move for him, and it's got to increase his chances of winning another Grand Tour, because the question about Demula has always been about team support, really.
Yeah. What it does also do is leave Sunweb in a bit of an invidious position, in the sense that, you know, 2 years ago, and this really shows how quickly things can change in cycling, 2 years ago Sunweb were the toast of the peloton, really, with the season they'd had with Dumoulin winning the Giro and just a fantastic season all round, Barguil winning a couple of stages at the Tour, Michael Matthews doing well at the Tour, and now all of a sudden they look a little bit directionless. And, you know, this is also the latest in a sequence of big names that they have lost, either, well, at the end of their contracts, or in Dumoulin's case and in Marcel Kittel's case, and I think Warren Barguil's case as well, before the contracts actually ran out. And we've discussed this before, the sort of environment that Sunweb is, they sort of pride themselves on well, they have this mantra, don't they, this hashtag keep challenging, and they really try to put that into practice. And there's a lot of sort of questioning of riders, a lot of trying to tweak their approach, a lot of communication between coaches, directors, sportifs, the management. And we've said before, it's not for everyone, and it's not for everyone at every stage of their career. It seems to work well with riders who are sort of on the up as far as their trajectory, their sort of bell curve is concerned, but less so maybe with riders when they've reached their plateau.
I mean, on Sunweb, it's worth mentioning Mark Hirschi, who has been a bit of a revelation the last few weeks, rode very well at the Bink Bank Tour as well. And they've got a few young riders coming through. Tish Benoit is obviously going there now. Leonard Kamna was very good at the Tour de France. They've got a few young riders, but yeah, they don't have... I mean, Dumoulin was such an obvious, talisman for them. Without him, It punches a big hole in their lineup.
And just on that issue, Rich, of big names leaving slightly unexpectedly in a lot of cases, it was something I discussed actually with Ivan Spekenbrink, the manager of Sunweb, a couple of years ago when John Degenkolb was about to leave Team Sunweb.
I mean, if you look to our industry, our sport, cycling, is we have a bunch of talented riders, but so has the competition. They have a bunch of talented riders. And then we have a bunch of talents also in terms of coaches, experts, etc. But they have as well. So at that moment, we're still not speaking about top sports. We're still speaking about a collection of talents racing us. And so when it becomes from collective gathered talent to real top sport, it means we need to have the best possible plan. And the best possible plan in such a tough sport, that means you need to be very, very committed to it. It's a very demanding approach. We call it the keep challenging approach. That we always have to optimize, let's say, the teamwork, the cooperation, and always keep innovating. And it asks a lot from people to do that with all your colleagues. So in a way, and for sure for young riders, it goes over the years, and we stretch it step by step gradually, that they do more and more in training, more and more in nutrition, more and more in aerodynamics and biomechanics, more and more in teamwork. You cannot all of a sudden put all of that on a young rider. You have to stretch it, and one can do more than the other. But that's how we work. So you need personalities who really are ambitious and who really want to give it everything. And young talents, they have the dream still ahead of them. They are really motivated and they're really committed. And as long as people want to give their full 100%, they stay welcome in a team. The moment we see the learning curve, the level of commitment is getting a little bit less because they have arrived at a certain level, they are happy, they want to take some comfort out of it. It's very good and we understand those choices. However, that's not strengthening the pure elite sports culture we have in our team based on constant innovation and cooperation. And the same for the staff. We need that people who know everything. We need people who want to know more tomorrow. We need people who really strive and are really driven to not be the best one, but become the best one and stay the best one in the future.
So that was Speckenbrink, the general manager at Team Sunweb, who's been, it's his vision that's driven that team all the way through the Argos Shimano years, the Giant Shimano, the Team Sunweb years. And Dumoulin moving on does kind of end a bit of an era, doesn't it?
It does, Rich. We mentioned Kittel, Degenkolb, Barguil, and Dumoulin. They were the four big stars, really, that team, that nursery, that sort of talent factory produced. There are still one or two domestiques who have been there pretty much for the duration. Roy Curvers is still there. But it's the end of an era, the end of a cycle for Sunweb. And I'm sure their philosophy is going to stay more or less the same. But personnel-wise, they really have to reinvent themselves to a certain extent now.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Harry's Razors.
I'm glad to hear Seb back in his usual duties there, not trolling me about France-Scotland rugby match at the weekend that he was at.
Did France by any chance beat Scotland at rugby?
Quite heavily.
Oh dear. It wasn't a close shave.
Oh, nice, Lionel. Nice. Stick to interrupting our episodes to remind the listeners that this week's episode is sponsored by, in this case, Harry's. Please, Seb. Thank you.
Yes. Know your place, Seb. Well, Richard, the Vuelta is coming up very soon. Are you all packed for your stint?
Not only packed, Lionel, but my stock of Harry's razors has been replenished recently. First thing in the, you get first name on the team sheet, first item in the wash bag. My spare cartridges, is that what you call them? They're little cartridges that appear with fresh razor blades just when I need them, just so that I don't have that, one of these things you forget in the supermarket along with batteries, razor blades. So I've got my razor blades for the Vuelta.
Well, any of our listeners can also get their hands on some Harry's razor blades. There is a special offer for Cycling Podcast listeners. You can get a full trial set for just £3.95. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling and you will get delivered to your door the weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. How are they so cheap?
Don't know, Lionel, but they're excellent razors, I should say, as well. Feel that.
I'm not touching your face, Richard. Sorry. I'll do a lot of things for the success of the podcast, but touching your face is not one of them, no matter how smooth it is. So if you want to be as smooth as Richard, go to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling and get your trial set of Harry's razors for £3.95.
Well, there was very sad news in the last week as well with the death of Felice Gimondi, the great Italian champion. And he wasn't that old, was he? And he had a sort of real air about him. He was one of these people that almost grows into his age a little bit, if you know what I mean. He always looked very elegant. And Daniel, you must have spoken to him when you did your Eddie Merckx book, because he features quite a lot in that.
Yeah, he does. There was this great moment when I was researching my book on Eddie Merckx, which was supposed to be really as much about the people who the riders whose career that Merckx had almost sabotaged as about Merckx himself. And Gimondi was foremost really among those riders. As we mentioned, as Lionel, you mentioned in the news roundup, he won the Tour de France in 1965, and as a neo-pro, 22 years old, and everyone believed, certainly the Italian media and the Italian public believed at that stage, that Gimondi was destined to dominate professional cycling. He'd finished third in his first Giro d'Italia, so 4 or 5 months into his professional career, he'd finished third in the Giro and then gone straight to the Tour, won that. So, you know, it was legitimate to believe that this was the guy who was going to dominate cycling for the next few years. And then Merckx came along and changed the narrative, really. And it was a really intriguing period, those years in the late 60s, when Merckx was sort of moving through the gears, and Gimondi found himself, well, mystified himself as to why he wasn't dominating. And it really came to a head, well, Gimondi told me that it came to a head in the 1968 Volta a Catalunya, of all races. The Volta a Catalunya back then used to take place in the September, and it was one of these great races, of which there have probably been dozens over the years, that they weren't televised and they've almost been forgotten, but that was really where this budding rivalry between Gimondi and Merckx came to a head, and the leadership sort of went back and forth, and then Merckx beat Gimondi in a time trial for the first time. And Gimondi spoke to me very poignantly and very vividly about the time trial and Merckx beating him, the first time he'd lost to Merckx in a time trial, and spending that whole evening, or after dinner that evening, going down or out of his team hotel and just sort of pacing up and down the beach, racking his brains. It was a beach called Playa de Rosas in Catalunya. Racking his brains as to what he could do, how he could possibly come to terms with the fact that there was a rider now who was better than him, stronger than him. And he said he spent hours just trying to wrap his head around it, and eventually, whether that night or over the next few weeks and months, he came to the realization that he was never going to be better than Merckx, and he was really going to be feeding off scraps for the next few years, and that's what he did, and he picked up some very prestigious scraps along the way, as you said, Lionel, in your roundup. You know, a fantastic palmarès, nine podiums in a row in the Giro d'Italia. I looked the other day, his first 18 Grand Tours he finished in the top 10, only the last two he didn't finish in the top 10. So an incredibly consistent rider, as you said, Rich, a very sort of graceful man, a very gentle man, particularly in his later years, which was not how he'd been as a rider. He was very tenacious, but he had a real sort of a calm, kind of soothing air about him. And from Bergamo, lived there all his life. He was a real institution in the Bergamo area. He'd actually learned to ride a bike, or on his mother's bike. His mother had been, I think I read or I heard once, one of the first post women in Italy, and she did all of her deliveries on her bike, come rain or shine. And Felice used to steal his mum's bike, a big sort of sit up and beg, you know, 20 kilo affair, and that's how he learnt to ride. And then, as I said, he spent his whole life in the Bergamo area. And Bergamo in the 90s really was the sort of centre, 80s, 90s was the centre of the universe as far as professional cycling was concerned. Riders, in the same way that they now flock to Andorra and Nice, it had a huge and incredible concentration of professional cyclists that lived there. And Gimondi was sort of the archduke of that whole scene, the sort of Zeus figure of cycling in Bergamo.
Yeah, you mentioned Bergamo. That's the only time I saw Felice Gimondi in the flesh, was when the Giro was in Bergamo a couple of years ago, and he came into the press room. And I think if you had to, not that I can paint, but if I was given the task of creating an oil painting of a stereotypical legendary retired Italian pro who'd really looked after himself in later life, you would come up with Felice Gimondi, wouldn't you? He's, you know, he had the sort of the streak of silver in the jet black hair, and
you imagine him in a well cut suit.
He was wearing a well-cut suit, exactly, yeah. And well, one thing that just sprung to mind last week was, if you are of the generation of cyclists who bought VHS videos of 20 years ago from Cycling Weekly, there was one French documentary called Pour un Maillot Jaune, for a yellow jersey. It's only about 20 minutes long, by French film director Claude Lelouch. I'm not going to try and describe the style of the film, because it's pretty esoteric, but I've just looked on YouTube, and it is actually on YouTube. If anyone wants to watch it, search for Pour un Maillot Jaune. The film is not about Gimondi, but you do get a sense of Gimondi's style both on and off the bike in that film.
Something that might not be online, but one of my most vivid kind of pictures, mental pictures of Gimondi is a bike review that Robert Miller did for Pro Cycling Magazine many years ago. I think testing a Bianchi with the brand with which Gimondi was very associated, and he went for a bike ride with Gimondi and just spent most of the bike review describing what it was like to ride with Gimondi and to sort of breathe in his air. And I think the sense I had was of a man still, you know, I guess this would have been like almost 20 years ago, so he'd have been in his early 50s at the time and probably still very fit, and a real, you know, sort of elegance about him on the bike then as well. And that's one of my most vivid pictures of him. But I don't think you'll find that online. I don't imagine.
I doubt it. I should also have said, Rich, that when I did interview Gimondi for my Merckx book, it was in the VIP enclosure, I think in Macugnaga, at the 2011 Giro d'Italia, and it was very serendipitous for me and very fortunate in the sense that I was interviewing Gimondi and who should come and sit down with us but Merckx, who was also there that day. And of course this led into this the conversation, them reminiscing about in particular that Volta a Catalunya that I mentioned. And there was a real warmth, and there has always been a real warmth between Gimondi and Merckx. And Merckx said the other day that that this time he'd lost in their rivalry because he'd lost a great friend in Gimondi. And Axel Merckx also, I noticed he tweeted something very a very fond message, a homage to Gimondi on the day after he died. So someone who'll be remembered with great affection by the whole Italian cycling community and the cycling community beyond Italy.
Well, at the Vuelta, we will once again be selling the beautiful mugs made by Stacey Snyder, the ceramicist from Virginia in the US. Well, we'll not be selling them. She'll be selling them directly. You'll find them on her website or through her Etsy site. Details in our newsletter. If you're not subscribing to our newsletter, please do so. Sign up at cyclingpodcast.com. We'll put details in there about how to buy the mugs and when they will go on sale. They'll be on sale at a precise time during stage one of the Vuelta. That'll be the first batch. The second batch will go on sale later in the race, assuming the first batch sell out, but the indications at the Giro and the Tour suggest that they will. Raising money for good causes. Now, lots of money was raised at the Giro and the Tour for some great causes. The time has come to select from your nominations again. We had lots of nominations again, none from the US this time. And we have tried to support good causes in the US because Stacey is obviously based over there, but we didn't get any from the US this time. A few that caught our eye, a few really good ones. One was from Ian Sisson, who suggested that Björg Lambrecht, a charity in his name or a fund in his name, would be a great choice, and it would. I got in touch with Lotto Soudal. It's a bit too early, I think, for Lambrecht's family to have chosen a charity or to set up a fund in his name, so maybe that's one for the future, but it was a great suggestion. The two that we will be supporting, one comes from Stephen Tunstall. He nominates the Bike Project, operating in London and Birmingham. Project collects old and unwanted bikes, fixes them up and donates them to refugees. Stephen himself is a volunteer bike buddy with the charity. That means he accompanies refugees after they receive a bike to help them build up confidence on the roads. Half of the beneficiaries are from Syria, Eritrea or Sudan. So Stephen sent us a few quotes as well from people who have benefited from the bikes. It's a bit different, this one, but we're very happy to support the Bike Project. The other one which caught my eye is a very nice email from Garrett Turley. Hope I've said your name correctly, Garrett. It's Andy's Man Club. He writes, in February, my best friend and my cycling buddy, Peter Hanlon, killed himself after years of mental health issues. He left behind three boys. He was 50. After the immediate pain reduces, the ripples from this tragedy will still be felt 50 years from now by those boys. This is a bit of a long email, but I'm going to read it in full because I find it quite moving. Peter and I would go cycling every year abroad for a long weekend in the mountains in France, but mainly in Italy. And on those trips, he could escape the pain of his mind and focus on the pain in his legs. His wife and eldest son described those trips as the happiest days days of his year, and his wife is also sure that it was only due to the thought of those, the training for them, and the pleasure he derived from them that he stayed alive so long. I feel immense sadness about his death, but I'm pleased I was able to help him more than I had perhaps fully understood. This is because Peter never really spoke to me of his problems, even though he was my best friend and I was his. That's in turn because he was a man, and ridiculously, we don't talk much. As you will know, suicide is the biggest cause of death in men from 18 to 45. Andy's Man Club is a charity that encourages and facilitates men talking about their problems in an effort to head off this disaster. You've recently had a few podcasts that have covered or mentioned the early deaths of cyclists, both male and female, from suicide. But there's another side. I know from my own cycling club that many men use cycling as a form of therapy to deal with work, relationship or health issues for themselves or ones close to them. The act of cycling, when you're looking forward rather than making direct eye contact, actually enhances open conversation and allows people to decide whether to tentatively open and explore issues on their own terms. After Peter died, I wondered what I could do to help beyond helping his family. One of my ideas was to sponsor one of your podcasts. Peter loved the podcast, of course. But he has instead suggested that we support Andy's Man Club as one of the charities, one of the good causes from the sale of the mugs. So those are our two good causes for mug sales from the Vuelta. And as I say, if you want details of how to buy them and when to buy them, please subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll put the details on social media as well.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Always very much appreciated, especially around Grand Tour time, because they came on board with us in 2016 at the Giro d'Italia and have been with us ever since, fueling us all the way, and you, because they offer 25% off to you, the listener, at scienceandsport.com with the code Lionel.
SISCP25.
That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com.
The robot may return at the Vuelta.
The Spanish robot with a Spanish-accented discount code for Science and Sport. But thank you to them. And we're looking ahead to the Vuelta. Well, you guys are out there for the early shift. But the Vuelta is on recent history, a race that sort of bursts into life pretty early on, doesn't it? Traditionally, with the way that the course is and so on, it doesn't have certainly this year, the Giro, it was a slow burn, wasn't it? The Giro, if it ever actually began burning at all. The Vuelta is more of a kind of firecracker. It gets off to an interesting start and carries on, and it looks like a very open race. I mean, we've got, I think, two exceptionally strong teams, haven't we? Jumbo Visma with Roglic and Kruijswijk, and Astana have announced quite a surprisingly strong team with Jakob Fuglsang, who crashed out the Tour. He's back for the Vuelta alongside Miguel Angel Lopez.
Superman.
Indeed. It's the return of Superman.
Oh, good.
And the Whalers. And Superman and the Whalers.
Oh, we've missed Superman, haven't we? But yeah, I mean, what are we expecting from this Vuelta? You two have studied the opening week.
Just off the top of my head, here are the 18 riders most likely to win a stage in descending order.
Oh, my goodness.
Sam Bennett, Fernando Gaviria, Primoz Roglic, Valverde, Fabio Jakobsen, Carapaz, Superman, Stibar, we got number 8, Nairo Quintana, Esteban Chavez, Philippe Gilbert, Max Valscheid, Jakob Fuglsang, Steven Kruijswijk, Thomas de Gent, Luca Mezgech, Dylan Teuns, and Pierre Latour.
You could have said Jumbo Visma for the team time trial on day one.
I didn't count that.
Oh, okay.
Well, Daniel famously dismissed Jumbo Visma's chances of winning a team time trial, exactly, if you recall, yeah, before the tour.
Exactly.
Yeah. In their press conference before the tour, somebody suggested Jumbo Visma might be a good shout for the team time trial, and you poo-pooed that idea after I suggested that it was a very good suggestion indeed. You guys, have you studied the opening week, the course, before we get onto the riders?
Yeah,
What can we expect?
Course and riders. Opens with what could be quite a spectacular team time trial down in Torrevieja. Lots of water in view, I think, of the course. It kind of comes down to a bit of a marina, I think.
Extremely disappointing opening team time trial in that it's clashing with the Arsenal-Liverpool game.
Oh, come off it. Come off it, Daniel. That's irrelevant.
There'll be lots of pubs around there showing that. Don't worry.
Oh, that's true.
There will. Yeah.
Don't you worry.
Suddenly chirped up.
Yeah.
Well, Theo Gegenhart, of course, is an Arsenal supporter, isn't he? Hopefully he'll have his eyes on the team time trial more than you will, Daniel, for Team Ineos. But Sam Bennett is fresh from three stage wins at the Bink Bank Tour. He's won a stage of every stage race, at least one stage of every stage race he's done this year, except the Tour of Romandy, where he finished second. They basically didn't bring in the breakaway. Stefan Kuhn won the stage and Bennett won the sprint for second. But he's really been remarkably consistent. And, well, his whole year has been defined by the fact that Bora Hansgrohe left him out of both the Giro d'Italia and Tour de France teams. We don't yet know what Bennett will be doing next season, but he will feel that he has a point to prove and show that he is capable of winning at the very highest level. Bora Hansgrohe have been pretty remarkable in the sense that they've won stages of 13 of the 15 World Tour races so far this season. That's more even than De Koenig Quickstep, who have won in 10 of the 15 stage races. So you would have to say Sam Bennett looks good for these opening two or three stages, which feature climbs towards the end, but are likely to finish in the sort of sprint where a strong man, as they used to say in the old days, a roadman sprinter, will come to the fore.
It doesn't have a lot of help. I don't know if that will matter a lot, but it's not a team that's been built to really offer him an awful lot of support. Shane Archbold is there, but not a lot. YMP Drucker maybe, but
see big trains in the world to do it.
No, we don't. True.
Course-wise, Napalm, I mean, one thing that stood out for me is that you don't, with the Vuelta, typically, and this is certainly the case this year, you don't get the crescendo towards a mountain range, then transition, then another mountain range, then basically the end of the race. There are mountains sort of dotted throughout the 21 days. In terms of sort of continuous tranches in the mountains, that one of the biggest ones is at the end of the first week, in the mountains sort of inland from the Costa del Azahar, so the sort of Valencia area, the Javalambre finish, which is a kind of a Tour de France style climb on stage 5, 11 kilometers at 7.8%. Then a very, very steep finish, which we've been to before in 2016, on stage 7, Mas de la Costa. Don't know if you remember that. I remember that mainly because Leopold Koenig was in with a shout for a stage win that day, riding for Team Sky, and I think he disobeyed team orders slightly, and I was looking for him after the finish, and Chris Froome was within earshot, and he heard me say, "Where's Leopold Koenig?" And he said, "Oh, he's probably on the Bora team bus by now." Koenig, of course, was going to Bora the following year, and he's barely turned a pedal for them.
Still on their books, isn't he?
Still not able to train because of knee problems. Anyway, so that is one of the goatiest of all goat tracks, Vuelta goat tracks, because that is 4.1 kilometers at 12.3%, and an obscenely steep climb, one of those sort of concrete roads we sometimes see at the Vuelta. So that's a nasty three-day swing at the end of the first week, and then there's a big stage in Andorra, 96 kilometers, three climbs that almost go to almost all of them are 2,000 meters. Landa won at where we're finishing that day, Cortal d'Encamp. He won there in 2015. 36 kilometer time trial around Po. Then a nasty stage finishing in Bilbao in the Basque Country, stage 12. But then, you know, it sort of dips in and out of different mountain ranges. Los Machucos, fond memories. Napalm of us going up there in 2017.
Well, that was when our friend Simon Gill, the photographer, took over driving responsibilities in your car because both you and your cameraman, Scott, were too nervous to drive up. It was slightly wet that day as well, wasn't
Very
it?
And wet. The roads were pitches
ridiculously
in some
steep, and we were struggling in your car to, well, there was a bit of wheel spinning and a bit of swearing in the back, but we got the job done. We got up there, very, very, well, it's very difficult climb, isn't it? Not least because the surface is so unusual. It's kind of concretey ridge slabs rather than a smooth road surface.
Well, yeah, I mean, I said that the Mas de la Costa was about as goaty as it gets in the Vuelta, but I think in terms of goatiness of the gradient, certainly Los Machucos is right there. 6.8 kilometers at 9.2%, but that doesn't really do it justice because there's even a bit that goes slightly downhill there, I think, that's factored into that. There are, like I say, 30% gradients on that climb.
I'm skipping Andorra. Richard will be there for Andorra and all the delights that has to offer. As you say, a time trial in France, Jurançon to Pau, an opportunity to have a glass of sweet Jurançon dessert wine with dinner, perhaps. And then, as you say, back into the Basque country, Los Machucos. And what's in store for me when I come back out for the final week, the stage to Guadalajara? It's all kind of a horseshoe shape round Madrid, isn't it, final week?
Well, I said we're going to Cantabria for Los Machucos, but then a couple of days in Asturias. Probably, I think the decisive mountain stages will be those two stages. Stage 15, the Santuario de la Acebo, and stage 16 to La Cubilla. Because in the last week, there are a couple of mountain stages, so we sort of decamped to the Madrid area in the last week, stages 17 inward. And they're not that hard, the last two mountain stages. In the Sierra de Gredos, where Bernardino sort of built his Vuelta win in 1983, famously. There was a famous stage into Avila, which some people say was the most memorable, the greatest Vuelta stage of all time. We got one climb this year that Hino sort of turned the screw on in 1983. But there's not that much scope in those stages for someone to really make a big move and really turn things around. I think the main ground is going to be made up and lost in Asturias on stages 15 and 16.
And who do we... We haven't spoken much at all about Richard Carapaz, the Giro winner. Hadn't raced until Burgos since the Giro. You know, looking at some of these guys' schedules, you know, that's a lot of time out of racing, and he could be in really good shape in a really strong team. Movistar going with the Trident again, this time Valverde and Quintana.
And with Soler as well.
And Soler, but one would think that Quintana fancies it. Some uncertainty though with his future and possibly moving on. Is he definitely moving on? We think he's moving on. I mean, Roglic is the other one, the other sort of outstanding favourite. I mean, they had two podium finishes from the Giro. Those two stand out, really, don't they? Who else are we looking at? Kind of curious about Pogacar, Tadej Pogacar, the UAE Team Emirates leader. He's only 20, though, so maybe unfair to expect too much from him, but he has been pretty consistent and pretty outstanding this year.
I've got Roglic 5 stars, Superman, Carapaz 4 stars, and Kreuzweg 4 stars, 3 stars Quintana, 2 stars Pogacar, Fuglsang, Chavez, Valverde, Aru, Martinez, 1 star Hart, Sosa, and Higuita.
It will be the usual mix, though, won't it? Not just in the GC battle, but also the stages. There'll be some surprises. There'll be some riders that we've not seen an awful lot of, either young riders coming to the fore. You know, the Vuelta is it's, in recent years, it's been a good place for young riders to get the first serious experience of a Grand Tour. And then, you know, every year Lotto Soudal seem to come up with someone who wins a stage from nowhere. I remember Tomasz Marcinski won a couple of stages a couple of years ago. Thomas de Gendt, of course, completing the Grand Tour clean sweep or full set this year, riding the Vuelta after finishing the Giro and the Tour. That's something to watch. I think the one thing that's predictable about the Vuelta is its unpredictability. I mean, you can look at last year's top 10 and think, well, of the riders who are returning, you know, Rigoberto Urán did quite well last year, but does it necessarily follow that he's going to, you know, be contending for the podium?
Forgot Urán in my stars. What do we think? 3 stars?
3 stars. 3 for Urán, yeah.
Consistent, isn't
and
he?
If he's going really well, that bumps up to four.
I TJ Van Garderen riding as well.
Yeah, they've got a good team. Is Carthy riding?
Yes, Carthy again.
I think so.
Expect good things from him. I think. I mean, yeah, it's a tough one to call. I mean, Fuglsang. It's only 6 weeks or so ago that we were talking about him as a favourite for the Tour de France. Has he really slipped down to 3 stars for Vuelta?
I mean, Fuglsang doesn't speak to the press an awful lot these days, but I spoke to some Danish colleagues today, and they said that he hinted at the end of the Tour de France that he would go to the Vuelta. Oh, sorry, he hinted after the Tour de France that he had to pull out of, that he was going to the Vuelta mainly to help Superman and possibly also to aim for a couple of stages. But I think he was keeping his options open as far as general classification is concerned. But I don't think he's putting too much pressure on himself to go in with the same sort of status as he had at the Tour.
A very strong Astana team, though, and we might see them do at the Vuelta what they failed to do at the Tour. I've mentioned already, Pogacar, what would you do with Pogacar? What would you expect from him? I mean, in a year when Bernal at 22 has won the Tour de France, I mean, he's a bit younger than that even, but he's already a kind of proven winner.
I'm interested to see what they do, because Aru rode the Tour de France. I think he finished 14th overall, and he's obviously coming back after his iliac artery operation earlier in the year, and has made sort of quite bullish noises about coming back to the sort of form that saw him win of Vuelta a few years ago. But how fresh is he going to be after the Tour de France? Is he really thinking that he can finish in the top 5 or top 10? Pogacar on reputation on Palmares, Aru should be the leader with Pogacar supporting him, but we've seen a lot more from Pogacar in the last year or so, haven't we?
Well, lots to look forward to at the Vuelta. We heard in last week's episode from Theo Gegenhardt, who apparently will lead Team Ineos at the Vuelta, but of course Ivan Sosa's put down a bit of a claim for that too, with some, I would say, it won't be unwelcome, his form, because he was a little bit disappointing at the Giro, I think, and he was the subject of a bit of a tug of love, wasn't he, between Trek Segafredo and Team Ineos, Team Sky, as they were last winter. A coveted rider, really, and it looks like he might be starting to deliver on the potential. So next time you'll hear from us, it will be in Spain at the Vuelta. Lionel with a handkerchief wrapped around, knotted around his head.
Socks and sandals in Benidorm.
Me in Vinny Samway's bar watching Arsenal. Liverpool. No, Vinny Samway's bar is in Malaga.
I'm sure there's one.
Well,
sure
don't go there, Daniel. That's miles away. That's kilometres away.
Yeah. Well, listen, before we go this week, let's just say a few quick thanks to friends of the podcast. A reminder, you can sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. If you do so, you'll be able to listen to Daniel's Lunch with Jonathan Vauters, which was released last week. And
Daniel's Lunch with Jonathan Vauters.
Sorry, Lionel's. Did I say Daniel?
Yeah, you did. But
Lionel's Lunch with Jonathan Vauters. And a tremendous listen that is to very, very personal. Very open and revealing, Jonathan Vauters, in that chat. Well done, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, we've had a few emails from people who enjoyed the conversation. So that's always nice to read. Thank you.
Great. Thank you to friends of the podcast who signed up some time ago. Rob Wicks, Jennifer Bryden, Sharon Chambers, Stephen Martin, George Sendell, Paul Woodman, Nick Worthington, Paul Locke, and Tim Roberts.
Tara Hodgson, Heidi Erickson, Peter King, Holt Hannah. Hannah Holt? Holt Hannah. I think it's Holt Hannah. David Arnold, Stephen Rose, Niall Cooling, Andrew Thornton, and Kim Shortreed.
And thank you to Felicity Taylor, David Robinson, Jonathan Sage, James Baker, Jochen Kindell, Richard Grant, Mark Gilmore, and Mark Simpson. Thank you very much.
And David Robinson, whose name you missed out as you scanned through that list.
Two David Robinsons there.
Oh, sorry.
I think he
sorry.
Signed up for two. I'm not.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Thank you twice,
editing.
David. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David. Thank you, everyone.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.